Most Christians know that Jesus told us that all the Old Testament testifies of Him. The challenge we face is knowing how. How are the stories in Genesis about Jesus? How are we supposed to find Christ in the dark and bloody book of Judges, or the wisdom sayings of Proverbs? To answer all these questions and provide a guide for readers of the Old Testament who are looking for Jesus, I wrote The Christ Key. I'm Chad Bird, and for over three decades, I've been studying and teaching the Old Testament. I wrote The Christ Key for you so you could unlock all the doors in the Old Testament, step inside, and say to each of them, "Show me Jesus." Visit ChristKeyBook.org to learn more.
Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you go to the events page and sign up for the event in Las Vegas, Nevada. That's going to be October 15th and 16th. You want to come hang out with Chad and me and a whole bunch of other people. It's only $65 to come hang out with us. It includes your lunch on Saturday. So make sure you get that, man, especially if you're within driving distance. I mean, if you're out there in the Southwest, you got to come hang out in Vegas with us in October. It's going to be a good time. We'll be talking about assurance. I mean, you can't afford not to have more assurance, and we're going to try to help you out with that. Today, not the day that this releases that you're listening to it, but the day that we're recording it is a big day because it's the birthday of Chad Bird's new book, The Christ Key. That is available definitely when you're listening to this everywhere, not for pre-order, for like buy it, have Amazon get it in your mailbox a couple days later kind of buy it. So if you've been waiting because you're one of those people who are like, I don't pre-order books, I don't do that, like I want it, I don't need to pre-order it, I just wait till it's out and then I order it, well, now's your time. Your moment has arrived. It's time to get it. I mean, if you're a fan of this podcast, there's zero chance that you don't like this book.
This is true. Yeah. If you've been listening to 40 Minutes of the Old Testament, then you're going to be reading this book and saying a lot of amens. Yeah, I remember that point being made somewhere along the way. So, yeah, I mean, I've told people that a long time ago, I mean, we're talking like two decades ago, I wrote a longer version of this book that is still on my computer. And I'm so glad. I think every author has like one book on their computer that will never be published. So that's mine. It's like 600 pages long. I mean, it was like this massive work that I did. And I am so glad that that never got published, because what I did is I took all of that material and I improved it. I streamlined it. I made it much more accessible and much more usable. And then I put it together in a 200-page book. So I'm glad that that became the Christ Key.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that when I was reading through this book that I was thinking was, you know, if you like the podcast, then you should buy this book. If you like the podcast and there's somebody in your life who you would love to listen to the podcast, but they don't listen to the podcast, this happens to me. Like, so I recommend a podcast to someone and discover that podcasting is not something they do. Like, there's still those people out there that don't listen to podcasts. But they do read books. So if the podcast is something that you like and you have friends or family that they don't listen to podcasts, but you wish there was a way for you to kind of give them the same thing that you're getting from the podcast and they read books, well, this is the way to do that. So if there's somebody, I don't know, maybe they're older, they don't do podcasts, you got a mom or a dad or a brother or uncle or whatever it is, and they're like, man, I'm really learning a lot from the podcast. I'd love for so-and-so to they would really like this stuff, but they don't do podcasts. This is the answer. You order them a copy of this book while you're ordering yourself a copy of this book, and they're going to get the same sort of hermeneutic that you're getting as you've been listening to the podcast. So do that. Make sure that, you know, you order Chad's book, because, you know, we all love Chad. So you got to support Chad. So just make sure you do it. All right. Well, we are in still a very unpleasant part of 2 Samuel. We've been making episodes that we don't really want to make for a couple weeks now. it's not quite as uncomfortable and gross as some stuff we've had to deal with recently, but it's not good.
No, it's not good. This is not a feel-good chapter. This is, as is a whole lot of the second half of 2 Samuel. This one, it's just a, we were talking before we started recording that this to me is kind of the antithesis to the parable of the prodigal son kind of chapter. So it's kind of like if you took the parable of the prodigal son and you kind of tore it up and then you pasted it back together in a real ugly sort of way, that would be this chapter. Because we've got a son who has gone to a distant land. We got two brothers who are part of the story. We've got a dad, David, who is not with his son. And then we have the return of the son. And we have a coming together of the father and the son, of David and Absalom. But there's no, like, dad running out there and throwing his arms around him and saying, hey, we're going to have a party because my son was dead and now he's alive. So you've got kind of all the elements of the parable of the prodigal son without any of the mercy and the true reconciliation that you have in the Gospel of Luke.
Yeah, you don't have anything about Absalom being gone and then coming to the, you know, coming to the end of himself. You don't have any of this. So it seems like
he seems to be quite full of himself.
Yes, repentance seems to be the key missing thing here.
Yeah, yeah. The Absalom we're going to see at the end of the chapter is like so narcissistic and full of himself that he's like his annual haircut is this great ordeal where he's going to weigh his hair. I mean. Anyway, it's some weird narcissistic stuff going on with Absalom.
Yeah, and the prodigal son, you have a guy coming back that's like, maybe my father will allow me to be a servant. That's like the opposite of what Absalom's thinking when he comes home. He's not thinking that maybe, just maybe, his dad will let him work for him. He's coming back thinking, maybe, just maybe, I could just have my dad's job.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. So when we left off last time, in the last chapter, toward the end of the last chapter, of course, we have the murder of Amnon by Absalom. At least he orchestrated the whole event and had his brother killed because, of course, his brother had raped his sister, his full sister. So you've got the family disintegrating chapter by chapter. David's family is just kind of falling apart, just like had been prophesied. So what happened with Absalom? Well, Absalom, after he arranged the killing of his brother, he takes off. He goes to a place where his grandfather was king, to the north of Israel. It's a place called Geshur. And he's staying there. He's there for quite a while. And we're told at the end of chapter 13 that, well, I think we talked about this. There's some ambiguity. So David is... one translation has he's longing to go out to Absalom. That's not really a good reflection of what the Hebrew has there. The Hebrew is ambiguous. Like, we know David is thinking about Absalom, but what is he thinking? Is he thinking positively? Is he thinking negatively? So we really have to look at this contextually. So based upon what we're going to see in David's actions, if his actions are a true representation of where he's at emotionally with regard to Absalom, then actually it's pretty negative. It's pretty cold. So that's the way 13 ends. 14 ends similarly. It says, Joab, the son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. Well, no, not really. There is in the Hebrew a tiny word, and it can be translated a multitude of different ways. So was the heart of the king upon Absalom? Was it going out to Absalom? Was it contrary to Absalom? We really don't know. I mean, how you translate that one little preposition cannot be determined from this singular verse. You've got to look at the entire context to decide exactly what the heart of the king is doing when it thinks about Absalom. And everything that is indicated, at least from my perspective, is that, yeah, David was thinking about Absalom. His heart was pondering Absalom, but not really in any kind of paternal merciful way where he was just kind of craving to have Absalom back. There's nothing really in the story that indicates that David wanted Absalom back. In fact, as we'll see, Joab has to arrange this kind of crazy scenario to make sure that David is tricked more or less into bringing Absalom back. So he's thinking about, Joab perceives that the heart of the king is thinking about Absalom, but we're not really told more than that. So what does Joab do? Well, Joab is he's a pretty interesting character here. We're going to see him becoming more and more kind of a, if not the central character, certainly a central character in the rest of the story, because he's going to be behind a lot of what happens with the rest of David's life. And Joab decides, he comes up with a plan. So he goes, he sends a message to a little city south of Bethlehem called Tekoa. If Tekoa is familiar to you, it's because that is where the prophet Amos is from. So if you have heard of Tekoa before, it's probably because you're familiar with the book of Amos, and Amos was a shepherd who was from Tekoa. So he goes to Tekoa, or he sends a message to Tekoa to get a woman from there who's called a wise woman. I'm thinking this is probably, in some of the commentaries that I have consulted, agree that this is probably almost sort of an official title. Like, this wasn't just a smart lady. It wasn't like Joab thought, you know what? There's this real smart gal down in Tekoa. I'm going to get her. This was probably almost an official or unofficial title for this particular woman. She's a wise woman. And he says to her, Joab says to this wise woman, here's what I want you to do. I want you to pretend to be a mourner and put on your garments of mourning, whatever those would have looked like. Don't anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who's been mourning many days for the dead. And I want you to go to the king, and I want you to speak thus to him. And then we're told at the end of verse 3 that Joab put the words in her mouth. So Joab gets her, he tells her what to say, even though he can't like put a whole speech in her mouth, because she's going to be engaging in a dialogue with the king. So he tells her more or less the story that he wants her to tell to the king, but she also needs to be able to be quick on her feet, because she's going to have to respond to the king in a way that is going to lead him, by means of this fictional story, to say what Joab wants him to say. So this is kind of a pretty obvious parallel to what we encountered earlier when Nathan came to David and told him the story of the rich man and the poor man having this dear lamb that the rich man took away. So this is going to be a somewhat of a repeat of this, even though this is much more elaborate. This is much more kind of an indirect sort of fictional story that David is going to have to be drawn into to elicit the kind of response from him that Joab wants him to have. But certainly the stories are, the occasions are parallel. David is going to have to be basically be tricked into becoming his own judge and jury. So he's going to have to be able to be drawn in by means of this fictional story, this parable, if you will, to say the words that he would not say on his own. And these words are going to be an indictment of himself, so that by means of this, he's going to be brought to actually bring Absalom back home.
There must be a certain softness that lives in David that people that are close to him know about. And maybe this is, maybe this is part of like the being a man after God's own heart, part of David, but these stories will always involve like desperation and injustice and all this kind of stuff. And like you're pleading with David to have compassion, and then to have a compassion that actually acts and does something to help you, to save you, right? To vindicate you, whatever it is. And this seems to work well with David.
Yeah. Both times he really like falls right into the trap. He's kind of a sucker, is probably not the best word to use, but he's sort of a sucker for one of these stories that just kind of grabs a hold of you, and you've got somebody who's suffering. They're kind of at the end of the rope. They're desperate. And it's like David can't help but respond to that. He certainly is going to identify with the man who lost his precious lamb, being a shepherd in the past himself. Now, this particular case is going to have the story that she's about to tell has these kind of this biblical resonance too, because it's going to be almost kind of like Genesis 4 retold, like Cain and Abel. So part of what's going on here too is that it's almost like she or Joab through her expects David also to be a kind of a biblical interpreter, if you will. Like, okay, the story she's telling sounds an awful lot like Genesis 4 and Cain and Abel. And what happened there? How did God, in other words, react to Cain after he killed Abel? Well, he put a mark on him, a gracious, protective mark. And so maybe I should act similarly. I mean, that's kind of implicit here. It's like they're expecting David to put two and two together and to act in accordance with biblical precedent.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get to it. We've kind of been jumping ahead, but here's what happens. So the woman comes to the king. She prostrates herself to the ground, pays homage to him, which is probably just kind of typical court behavior when you appeared before the king. She starts out by saying, "Save me, O king." Again, probably just kind of a formal response, a formal declaration. When you went to the king and you had a problem that you wanted him to solve or to address, then this is the way you started out. So the dialogue begins. She says, "Save me, O king." The king says, "What's your trouble?" And here's the story that she tells. Of course, the story that Joab has concocted. She says, "Alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead. And your servant had two sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field." Of course, this we're picking up on our Cain and Abel, right? Same thing happened with them in the field. Two sons, two brothers. "There was no one to separate them," she goes on, "and one struck the other and killed him." This, of course, like Cain killed Abel. Now, so that's she's without a husband. All she has left are two sons. One has just killed the other. So now all she has is the one surviving son who has blood on his hands. Verse 7 presents the real issue. She says, "Now the whole clan has risen against your servant, and they say, give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed." So that's what she is reporting to David. They're saying to her, so give up your other son, your only surviving son, the only one who's left, because we need to exact blood vengeance against him.
Yeah, this guy's got no mark to protect him. So I mean she's no literally mark. Asking David for a mark.
Oh yeah, this is exactly right. Yeah, she's saying, I need you, David. Please put a mark on my son. Protect him. That's clearly implied here. So then she goes on. She says, so if they do that, they would destroy the heir also, meaning that, you know, everything my husband has is now going to be lost. And she presents a beautiful metaphor here. She says, if they do this, they would quench my coal that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. So it's this image of all she's got left. It's like at one point she had a raging fire. She had a husband, she had two sons, she is warm in the glow of this raging fire of peace and hope. Everything is just the way she wants it to be. And then all of a sudden her husband dies and the flame dwindles, and then her two sons quarrel, one kills the other, and the flame goes down to where all that's left is one ember, one coal that needs to be fanned into flame. But here we have this crowd, this clan, who are wanting to basically take that coal and pour the water of judgment upon it, and thus extinguish all hope that she might have left. So that's her case. That's her story. And we're going to see that she elaborates on this more and more. She is a very wise woman as we go along here. But notice what happens. So the king's about to respond, and every time he responds, he doesn't give her enough. He'll like be kind of ambiguous, and she like a good lawyer, she keeps pressing and pressing and pressing, trying to get him to say what she wants him to say. So he first responds by saying, "Go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you."
Yeah, that's not going to work.
I don't really think that's going to work. That is way too ambiguous. Go to your house and I will give orders concerning you. What the heck does that mean?
The orders could be, you know, her son is located over here. Go kill him. I have no idea what these orders are.
I will give orders concerning you. So she's thinking to herself, no, we got to have something more than that. So she responds to the king. We had this back and forth, back and forth. On me be the guilt, my lord the king, and on my father's house. I think what's happening here is that she's interpreting David's hesitancy to mean that, hey, he doesn't want the responsibility for the blood guilt to be transferred to him and to his administration.
Yeah, David's like, look, I got enough blood on my hands. I don't need to be going around absolving people of murder.
I don't need to step into the middle of this. So that's why she says, look, this is not going to be on you. It's on me be the guilt, my lord, and on my father's house. So let the king and his throne be guiltless. So she's trying to persuade him to say a little bit more. So he does. He goes on. He responds to her. He says, if anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall never touch you again. So he's giving her a little more now. He didn't just say, I'll give orders concerning you. He says, I'm not going to let anybody harm you. But that's not what she wants. She's not worried about herself. She's worried about her son. So she responds to that. She says, please let the king invoke the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more and my son be not destroyed. So here she's brought it to a point. She's like, okay, that's very nice of you to say what you've said, O king, but here's really what I'm asking from you. I want you to bring the Lord's name into this and to swear on the name of the Lord that my son will not be harmed. And that's precisely what he does. She finally elicits from David the response that she and, of course, Joab through her wanted. David says, as Yahweh lives, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. It's a pretty good promise.
It's pretty good.
I mean, it's pretty hard to improve upon that. If the king, the ultimate authority in the land, says, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground, then you have got probably actually more than you were hoping to get. That's quite a promise from the king. Not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. Same language, by the way, or same image that was used way back in 1 Samuel 14, I think, when you remember when Saul made this ridiculous prohibition where none of the warriors were supposed to eat on the day of battle, and Jonathan did. And then Saul at first was to me like, well, I guess I'm going to have to execute my son. All the people were like, nope, that's not happening. Not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground.
Yeah.
So this was a repeat of that same image.
This is one of the more impressive things about this. Like, I don't know where Joab found this woman. I mean, I know it says that he found a wise woman. He also found a very courageous woman because,
I mean,
I don't know how you talk someone into this. Be like, because it's not just like, okay, here's what I'm going to need you to do. Like, maybe you got a little sack of gold coins. I don't know what you got, but you're like, here's what I'm going to need you to do. I need you to go tell this story to the king and try to elicit this reaction from him. Okay, maybe it doesn't work, and you come back and be like, well, it didn't go well. But nothing terrible is probably going to happen, you know, from you doing that. You doing this next part, though, like if the plan is like, and once you get him to make you a promise, here's what you do, dude. Like,
oh, bold, yeah, very.
Like, I'm not signing up for this.
yeah, she, wise woman for sure, courageous woman definitely.
I mean, imagine definitely. You're like, I mean, someone's like, okay, here's what you need to do. We're gonna set you an appointment with the president. You're going to go in, tell him your circumstances. You're going to get these guarantees from him. Then you're just going to flip that script on him about his own family. I'd be like, no freaking way.
Yeah. go talk to the next candidate for this suicide mission. Yeah. So, okay. She's got him where she wants him. Not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. I mean, this is so she now is the same place that Nathan was earlier. when David pronounced this judgment against this fictitious rich guy who had taken the lamb away. So David has just pronounced basically that same kind of judgment. So the woman gets what she wants, just like Nathan got what she wants, and now she's turning the tables. So Nathan said, "You are the man." And now the woman says, in a much more humble but also very direct sort of way, she says, "Please let your servant speak a word to my lord the king." And he says, "Speak." And here she goes. She says, "Why then?" So having said all that you said, David, "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God?" Whew. It's at this point where David realizes, oh, man, again, I've just been tricked again.
That's a bold,
then have you planned such a thing against people of God?
It's a bold way to start, man.
Ooh, yeah.
This isn't sort of like, let me just say this.
Think about it this way.
This story is a little similar to something that you have going on in your own family. This is just bringing the hammer down.
Yeah, she decides she's going to lead with the sharpest instrument that she has. "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision," in other words, in saying what you just said about this story that I've told you about my fictitious two sons, "the king convicts himself. Inasmuch as the king does not bring his banished one home again." So now, of course, in David's mind, everything is becoming crystal clear. Now, 14 and 15, she goes on, and some of this is perhaps, at least to me, it's not immediately clear. And the woman seems to kind of go back and forth between addressing the reality of David and then almost also living in this fictitious story that she came up with. But anyway, I'll just read it and we'll unpack it. Verse 14, "We must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again." Beautiful, beautiful metaphor, by the way. We're all going to die. We're like this water spilled on the ground, can't be gathered up again. "But God will not take away life, and he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast." So I think what she's saying here is, listen, and some of this is indirect, but at least my reading of this is she's saying, listen, your son Amnon is dead, just like we all have to die. You know, if you spill water on the ground, you can't somehow gather it up again. You can't bring Amnon back, no matter what you do. So if you think that you're doing the right thing by keeping Absalom away, thinking that this is sort of somehow kind of the virtuous thing to do, it's not doing any good. You're not bringing him back to life again. So do the right thing. Actually, the virtuous thing to do, the good thing to do, would actually to bring the banished one home again, whom she never names, by the way. She doesn't say Absalom. She just says the banished one. So bring him home again so that he won't remain an outcast. That's the way that I hear this.
And this is a interesting thing to say because, you know, I mean, according to the law, Absalom should die for this.
Yeah, he not only should be, he shouldn't have just been banished, he should have been put to death.
And even in the story that she tells, she's asking him to do something contrary to law. She's asking for protection from the law.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, what she appeals to is this gospel message, which is wrapped up in sort of these words. So she's saying, like, look, everyone's going to die. You can't fix what's wrong by just inserting the law. So applying the law to this situation, this sinful situation, doesn't fix it. It doesn't make it better. It doesn't help you. So instead, she's like, do something different. Do something that's completely different than the law. In fact, it's so completely opposite of what the law would say. Do that instead. And I think this line is just wonderful sort of gospel and what she thinks God is like, which is different than what the law would say, which is God will not take away life. What?
Yeah.
Since when?
That's
right?
An arresting line right
yeah,
there.
Like, that's wild. So she says, God will not take away life. And he devises means. So he comes up with a way. He invents a way so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. Now, that's just the gospel. I'm sorry. That's just the gospel.
There's a sermon right there. Yeah.
Oh, dude, this is a, you could just grab that text and preach a sermon on that. Like, so she's asking David to do the Jesus thing here, but this is a statement about actually how God is going to deal with people who deserve death.
Mm-hmm.
And that God is instead going to be like, you know what? I'm not going to just kill everyone the way the law demands. Instead, I'm going to devise a way. I'm going to plot and come up with a way that all of the banished ones don't have to remain outside. They can all come back. That's wild.
That is wild. Yeah. So whether intended or not, this woman has just proclaimed a universal truth about the way that God deals with fallen humanity.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Which is completely contrary to everything that David is told in the law to do in these circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is kind of a do a Genesis 4 kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Put a mark on him. That is, act in mercy. Don't act in injustice. Act in mercy. Because it so happens that we have a God who devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. That's a universally applicable statement of mercy right there.
Yep.
Fantastic. And then she goes on. This is verse 15. Now I have come to say this to my Lord the King, because the people have made me afraid. I'm not sure who she's talking about here, unless this is an allusion to Joab. And your servant thought, I will speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his servant. For the king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the heritage of God. Now, this is where it's almost like she's slipping back into her fictitious story. You know, like she's worried about this son that she's just kind of come up with. But anyway, that's what she says to the king. And then she goes on, and your servant, that is, she thought, the word of my lord the king will set me at rest. For my lord the king is like the angel of God to discern good and evil. The Lord your God be with you. So she is, she's speaking very highly of David here. Now, from our perspective, David's not very angelic. She says, oh, you're like the angel of God to discern good and evil. Well, I think she's being very flattering to the king, but we know otherwise. David is no angel. Everything that's kind of been happening here is because David actually was not like the angel of God to discern good and evil. He was actually doing a lot of evil on his own. And then she ends it by saying, the Lord your God be with you. So at this point, a lot of things could happen, right? I mean, he could be angry, right? David could be angry because he's been deceived. I mean, he's really been lied to by this woman. Or he could do the opposite of that. And we'll see here what he chooses to do. This is verse 18. So the king answers the woman, don't hide from me anything I ask you. And the woman says, let my lord the king speak.
This seems like he's like, okay, let's put the story aside.
Yeah, can we stop the fiction?
Like, let's stop like moving in and out of this story. Like, you got me. So like, let's just have like a real conversation now.
Yeah. Let's drop all the pretend and tell me in verse 19, is the hand of Joab with you in all this?
There you go.
In other words, listen, is Joab the one behind all this? Come on, let me know. Just come clean. Let me know. And the woman, to her credit, answers truthfully. She says, as surely as you live, my lord the king, one can't turn to the right hand or to the left from anything that my lord the king has said. In other words, yeah, you're right. It was your servant Joab who commanded me. She goes on. It was he who put all these words in the mouth of your servant. I think she's being a little bit humble there, because I guarantee you she was improvising. She had to. There's no way that Joab could have said, okay, I want you to say this, and this is what David's going to say. Then I want you to say this, and then this is what David's going to say.
Yeah, unless Joab knows David better than anyone's ever known anyone.
Yeah, Joab would have to be a prophet to be able to give her all the words. So anyway, that's what she says. Yeah, it was. He's the one who did it. Verse 20 tells us why. It says, in order to change the course of things. So to alter the course of events, your servant Joab did this. But my Lord has wisdom like the wisdom of the angel of God to know all things that are on the earth. There she is, flattering the king again. Now, why did Joab? I guess we didn't talk about that. And part of the reason is because we don't know the answer. Why is Joab doing these things? It's kind of an open question. I mean, so why does Joab want him back? Because there's all kind of speculation out there if you read the commentaries. So is Joab kind of pro Absalom? Well, there's really no indication as to why he would be, unless, and he's my suspicion, and this is just my suspicion, is that Joab is actually worried that unless there's a reconciliation between David and Absalom, that Absalom is one of these days going to become a real threat to the kingdom. Now, of course, he doesn't know that actually that's what's going to happen anyway, but I think Joab is afraid that with Absalom not reconciled to his father, that there's going to be war. And so he's trying to bring peace to a very difficult situation here. He's trying to bring Absalom home so that the king and his son can be reconciled and there's going to be peace in the kingdom. Of course, I mean, Joab is a military commander. He's always kind of thinking, you know, what might happen with regard to wars and how can we create peace? And so from my perspective, that's his motivation here. He's trying to avoid what could be a national catastrophe.
I think that that's probably right. I think that also there's a very human element to this, and that's that Joab knows what it is to do a revenge killing and to be sort of outcast and shamed for it. I think there's probably a real sympathy that Joab has for Absalom, understanding why he did what he did. I mean, this is exactly the sort of thing that Joab did. And so, and Joab had to sort of endure the shame of that. And they, you know, one thing that's sort of, is true about sinners, when you've sinned in like some specific way, you can, it's easier for you to, have sympathy for those who sin in that way as well.
And so, similarly. Yeah.
And so, it makes sense, complete sense to me that Joab would be the guy that would say, you know, not say that what Absalom did was good or right, but there's definitely, Joab understands it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. And we saw how David treated Joab afterward. I mean, he basically publicly humiliated him. And so Joab, knowing what he went through and understanding probably better than anybody why Absalom did what he did.
Yeah.
He has, yeah, he's got sympathy. He's got compassion for him. And keep in mind too, these guys are all family.
Right.
So Joab isn't someone who's just, you know, somebody that kind of rose through the ranks. He's David's nephew. So he's also, of course, related to Absalom. So this is it's a national concern. It's a compassionate concern. It's a family concern, all these together. So how does David finally respond to everything? He says to Joab, verse 21, he says, look, I grant this. Go, bring back the young man Absalom. And when David says that, I'm thinking, oh, thank God. You know, this is going to be great. David has finally been brought to his senses, been brought to realize this is the good and gracious and merciful thing to do.
I do think it's interesting, though. I think there's a little bit of a tell here. David says, okay, fine. He doesn't say, bring back my son, Absalom. He says, bring back the young man, Absalom.
Yes.
And I think there's a hint there that David's going to go along with this because he got caught up in his own words and he's going to go ahead and do it. But there's still something there because it doesn't say that David started weeping and said, bring my son home or something like this. He just says, bring the young man, Absalom, back. He doesn't even say home. He just says, bring him back, you know? And so I definitely think that there's something there if you're reading carefully where you're like, you could get caught up like, all right, good. Like, this is good. There's going to be all this forgiveness and reconciliation, but there's something in there that tells you like, this is not quite as pure as the prodigal son.
Yeah. And we're going to see more of that in just a second as we wrap up this. So Joab's overjoyed. I mean, verse 22, he falls just like the wise woman from Tekoa did. He falls on his face to the ground. He pays homage. He blesses the king. And he says, today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord the king, and that the king has granted the request of his servant. So Joab is happy. This is exactly what he had hoped he would achieve through this, you know, pretty elaborate scenario that he set up with this woman. So Joab, we get the impression like he runs out, gets a chariot or gets his saddles his horse or mule or whatever, and he takes off. He arises and goes to Geshur and brought Absalom back to Jerusalem. And then, I hate to end on a sour note, but we're told the king said, verse 24, let him, that is Absalom, let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence. So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence.
Yeah, so that you get a hint and you get the whole thing rather quickly.
Yeah, so this is we're not at the end of the chapter. We have more that we'll get to in the next episode, but you already can tell this is not the Old Testament version of the parable of the prodigal son. Because David doesn't, it's not like when, you know, Absalom is at the edge of Jerusalem, out of the palace runs King David with his robes flapping in the wind, and he throws his arms around Absalom and kisses him and tells the servants to bring the ring and the sandals and the best robe and to kill the fatted calf because his son is home again. He's like, I won't even see you. You're not living under my roof. You're going to stay in your own house. And as we'll see in the rest of the chapter, this continues for quite a while. So what's going to be the resolution of all this? Is there going to be any kind of final coming together of father and son? What's that going to look like? Well, we'll find that out in the next episode after we hear about Absalom a little bit more and how much he likes his hair and all that good stuff.
Yeah, this is what you have here is Joab trying to put together an Old Testament prodigal son story. And what you find out is that, well, David is a type of Christ. He is not Christ.
Amen to that.
and so the story doesn't work.
Story does not work. No, we're going to have to wait for the Gospel of Luke to get the real parable of the prodigal son.
That's it. All right, guys. Well, that's it for this episode. Make sure that you go out there and order Chad's new book, The Christ Key. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can just click on that and order that. And we'll see you next week.
See you then.